Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Hello. Before we start the show, I wanted to send a quick message to those who are aiming to run the London Marathon next year. Now, I know the ballot places came out today, and I know lots of people have entered the championship race. And if you're lucky enough to have a place in 2020, then Shelter would really like to be part of their team. There's no minimum fundraising target when you have your own place. You just raise whatever you can, and you'll be joining a team of 200 runners who are together aiming to raise over £450,000. Now, obviously, running the marathon is a huge challenge, and this year, Let's Get Running and us will be aiming to provide coaching support. So we'll be providing training plans, and we're putting on a marathon workshop we can attend and get some advice on how to approach the marathon from a training perspective, and also some fundraising tips from Shelter. On the day itself, obviously, there'll be lots of cheer points along the course to keep you going, and at the end of the race, there'll be a hero's welcome at the post-race reception. There'll be complimentary food, drinks, and that all-important post-marathon massage. Team Shelter really needs you this year. In the UK, it's estimated that every 19 hours, a person who is homeless dies. And it's not just those who are sleeping rough who are affected. Statistics estimate that more than 30% of deaths since 2017 have actually occurred where people were living in emergency or temporary accommodation. We desperately need to fight for more stable homes for families, older renters, and working people. And we need to give advice to people who don't know where to turn. Shelter needs your help to deliver this. So when you fundraise for Shelter, you'll be changing the lives of millions of people who suffer every year from bad housing or homelessness. You'll be making sure they have access to advice, support, and legal services they need. You're part of a movement which is fighting to make sure that one day no one needs to turn to Shelter for help. It's great if you can be involved. If you want to be part of Team Shelter, and you just want to, or you just want to find out a bit more information, then please email running@shelter.org.uk, and Helen will be there to help you. Now, on with the show. Hello. Welcome along to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast. How is the Caramel Kid?
I'm good. What's Sean and Sean saying?
He's good. He's just put the baby to bed. It's Wednesday night. It's raining here again, about the 10th day in a row. Tired, man. My baby's been ill, so she's been off nursery. I usually work on Tuesdays, but she's been ill, so it's been a long week.
You only work one day a week?
2 days a week. Well, technically, I think...
I'm hanging out right now.
Yeah. I think I'm working with the baby, do you know what I mean? It's hard work. It's tiring.
It's your own baby. Yeah. That should be free love.
Man, if you had to look after a baby all day, it's a tough job. Well, these ladies that stay at home and look after children on their own, man, it's tough.
I look after my dog all day when my day's off. You know what I'm saying?
Your dog can sit down on its own for half an hour. These babies, they require constant supervision. Jesus. Yeah, I love her, but she's been hard work this week, and it's not our fault. She's just been ill, so I'm tired.
What have you been doing?
Not much running. I'm going to take some time and come back to running. Like, I was absolutely gassed after that last hill running race, and I'm just not recovered
you
yet.
You can't say gassed.
Okay. Why can't I say gassed?
Because, like, the street term of gassed means, like, you're hyped, you're ready, you know, like, you're super happy.
Right, yeah.
So when you say I'm gassed, it's like, you're not gassed.
No, I was
more
knackered.
More like you're deflated.
Deflated, okay, yeah. I'm deflated from that. And yeah, I can't get back any energy. So I've been struggling for 8 minute miles. My heart rate's been all over the place. I think I've overdone it big time. I think I've overdone it for a couple of years, to be honest. So yeah, I need to find a way to get back in the red. And I'm not going to race now until January. So I'm going to have at least 4 months off. I'm going to come back to running, but for the time being, I'm just going to jog and do a bit. I'm just doing a bit with the coach, Martin. So. Yeah, we'll see.
So, no cross country when we come in December, no?
Yeah, I might still do it, but.
See? You can't help yourself. You can't help yourself.
Yeah. I might just do a couple of races just to enjoy a bit, only as training, because I love the old cross. Yeah, I love it. But I'm not going to train hard. I'm not going to do any serious training. Really, just going to keep myself ticking. And then I'm going to go for Berlin next year. One more time. I've got to get a good time, man, at marathon. I've got to do it. So, yeah, Berlin is my target, I think, next year. I've spoken to Martin about it. He thinks it's probably a good idea. Half marathon in March. Maybe the Venloop in the Netherlands. If you know the Netherlands, that's a pretty quick race. I think they're running, like, there's, like, guys running low 60, and there's tons and tons of Africans doing it. So I'm going to do that. And I'm going to try and do the Paralope in Brunsum, which is a 10K. And then I'm going to try and run fast in Berlin, maybe, if I can get a little spot. Actually, I've got rent of that. I've got to do it this week, but yeah, that's the plan. See how it goes down. Yeah. What about you? What have you been up to?
No, not that hectic.
Okay. No,
football got cancelled. So I decided to go Pokemon instead.
Right, okay. How did that go?
And then my first match was against this guy. I turned up late, and then he didn't even have a mat. He's thinking of alcohol, so he's been out clubbing. So I was thinking, oh, this is an easy win.
Yeah.
He beats me, so I'm gruffing.
Yeah.
And then I lose my first three games, so I just go on. I said, I'm done. I'm done.
You could have turned it around, surely.
No. Because there wasn't enough people to get big points.
Okay.
So it was only top four, and obviously I would have struggled to make top eight, so there was just no point staying.
Oh, jeez.
But apart from that, working, it's been crazy.
Yeah. How's the bus?
Because you don't know at the moment, loads of protests in London.
Oh, yeah.
All the Greenpeace nut nuts.
Yeah, the Extinction Rebellion.
It's so funny. It's good for me. Because basically, we go to Waterloo and we stop.
Yeah.
We'll wait there for an hour and then drive back out of London.
Yeah.
Because we can't go through central London.
Yeah.
So all the passengers, when I kick them off at Waterloo, they all got their flags and banners and stuff. They're going, oh, we need to get to Charing Cross or, you know, Parliament, Westminster.
Yeah.
I'm like, you got to walk or get the tube. They go, well, what's wrong with the buses? I say, well, your people are blocking the roads. Because they've been doing crazy stuff like gluing themselves to the street, chaining themselves on the lorries, and I was thinking, that's what you get.
You got to walk somewhere.
But my story is yesterday.
Yeah.
I was driving early, so what was it? It was like 4:30. It was super early.
Yeah.
And I pull into a stop. People get on, and there's all this in the distance. There's someone walking in a road. You know, like you think, oh, there's some yobs walking in the road. So obviously, close the door, and I'm driving on. And it's a woman walking in the middle of the road on her own. And she's sticking around now in the middle of the road to make the bus stop.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking I could go onto oncoming traffic because there is none because it's so early and just go around her. But I was thinking, oh, maybe she might, you know, like come across and then I'm stuck.
Yeah.
So I slowed down and then she's like, I want your bus. And she's miles from the bus stop. And I'm like, yeah. Okay. Yeah. And then she's walking around the side. She gets to the doors. And I'm like, no. And then I drive off. You damn right. Try to put my buster hostage. Are you mad? Not on my bus. Not on my bus.
Was she a total nut job?
No, I think she was a little drunk. But she just assumed by standing in the middle of the road, she could force me to stop, obviously, because I'm not going to run her over.
Yeah.
And then demanding that I open the doors to let her on. otherwise she's not moving. So the only way is like you agree with them to get them out of the way of the bus. Yeah. I didn't open. So when they get to the doors, I'm like, yeah, bye. And then I just drive off.
She could have been in big trouble, Jermaine. Think about it. She could have been. You read it on the news tomorrow. Yeah, woman in.
S-E, but that's someone else's problem, yeah.
So you heard it here. Don't if you're drunk in the middle of London at 6 a.m. Don't walk in the middle of the road. Jermaine's not going to pick you. Well, he's going to threaten to pick you up, and he's not going to bother. That's how it goes. Yeah, but hey, but the World Championships happened, Jermaine. We watched them. Do you enjoy it?
It was all right, I guess.
Yeah. Okay. Nothing that outstanding. I mean, there were some good races, distance running races. I can't remember a lot of them.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah,
I think next year. Tokyo, that's what I'm looking forward to. Yeah. That should be a good one.
Yeah. Did you get any winners on our little competition?
Here we go. You want to blow your own trumpet, don't you?
Yeah, I think I won. Yeah.
I got one.
Yeah.
I got Hassan in the 15.
Nice. Any more?
And I got Semenya DNS, didn't start.
Yeah.
The Israeli 10K disappeared.
Yeah, yeah.
Suleiman, the 1500, he got knocked out in the heats. No good to
Did
me.
Did he? Yeah, okay. Yeah, what about the steeplechase?
And then,
wait a minute. Hang on, you got a women's steeplechase, didn't you, I think?
Kenyan, the steeplechase.
Yeah, she won it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got that.
And the men's?
Men's 800. Who did you give men's 800 for? He went out in the heats.
I had Amos. He was injured. Didn't start.
So it's a Jermaine kiss of death.
Whatever I say, don't listen to me.
Yeah. Well, I didn't get that many more. I think I got the women's marathon. I got the men's 10,000. I got the women's 10,000. Who did I pick for the women's 8?
You got men's 15.
I didn't get women's 15.
No, men's 15. You got that Kenyan.
Oh, yeah. Men's 15. And then that was it. I think that was it. So I got four, right?
The Brits did good in the men's 15, to be
fair
to them.
Yeah, they did really good. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They all made the final and they were all in the mix. So yeah. That was good.
Yeah, it was great that. It was, and it was complete opposite to the men's 800. Where they all
well, that's
just
what you get.
Bombed.
Well, that's what you get when you pick people that finish last in the trials.
Yeah, but it's all gone off of British Athletics because he's retired, hasn't he? Well, not retired. He's resigned, or he's fallen on his sword. Black, Neil Black.
Has he?
Did you see that? Yeah, yeah. The performance director Neil Black has resigned today, which is about time.
He's half of the UK funding go towards relays, so they rely really heavily on relays.
Yeah,
and then they only got 2 medals, and then they were trying to get the third one because they came fourth, and then trying to get Jamaica to squad up. But apparently, they didn't put the appeal in properly, so they managed to stay fourth.
Yeah, crazy. So they didn't. They could have got it if they had appealed properly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ridiculous. Yeah. And it's the main reason.
It's kind
of
bad though because you know, like they didn't take Phil Norman. I know I keep moaning.
Yeah.
Because they wanted medal potentials.
Yeah.
Like, how many men's medals was there?
None.
Exactly.
Yeah. Crazy.
Because obviously, individual women, because Ashley got 2, Kate Johnson Thompson, and then relays.
Yeah.
So they were predicting 7.
Were they?
So they came up short. Yeah.
And it's basically, he's, they've relied, since 2012, they've relied on a couple of one or two individuals, haven't they? And he's just got lucky. He's got lucky that he had Mo Farah winning a few gold medals for him. He's not really done anything, has he? On a high paid wage. And the reason why he's quit is because of Salazar. Because he apparently back in the when he first started working with him, he described Salazar as a genius in 2011. A genius at getting past the anti-doping. But yeah, so he's had to go. I'm quite glad about that, actually. It's good to see that.
Yeah, but
gone.
Who? Because I know above him is Zarahai Peters, but who's going to be next? Is there any people who's going
to say who's going to? I'm looking at the BBC, and there doesn't appear to be anything. So it's Charles Uncommonly left, and then he took over in 2012. But he hasn't done anything, has he? He's been a bit. I'd say his whole.
Well, I'll give you a good example.
Yeah.
When we was in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're training with Jamma. Mo turns up to train.
Yeah.
And he's with Charlie Grice.
Yeah.
So, and they're training. It's fine. But they've got Neil Black. And Neil Black's taking photos of Charlie Grice and Mo so they can put it on their Instagram. So basically, it was their photographer.
Really?
This is the head of him living their photographer.
What? He's got better things to do. Ah, he's been a real failure. Real failure. So, yeah, he's gone, which is good. Well, I shouldn't say a man losing his job is not a good thing, but if you're not doing a good job, you've got to go. So I'm glad. I'm in a way that's see what's happening next. And actually, our interview touches on all the controversies of the games. So we can talk about why what happened in Doha, why it was controversial, what the championship's actually like, and also the Salazar ruling. Nike and their shady dealings behind it all. We're going to talk about all of this with Cathal Dennehy, and he's going to be on that. He's a journalist. He works with The Guardian, The Irish Times, Runner's World, you name it. He's got an article there. I highly recommend you follow him on Twitter. And if you do that, you'll see, pick up some of his articles there. And he's going to chat about the success of the championships now. Here he is. So on today's show, I'm speaking to Cathal Dennehy. How you doing, Cathal?
Very good. How are you?
Very, very good. And you've just come back from Doha. You've literally landed the last couple of days.
Yeah, I just got back, the long 15-hour journey home through Istanbul yesterday. So as you can imagine, the fatigue is quite high at the moment. But it was an interesting championship. I'm actually glad for the first time ever to see a bit of rain back home in Ireland here. Because needless to say, it did not rain in the desert for the last 12 days. And being back on a usual sleep routine is also a bit of a delight after the chaos of our world championships.
Yeah, wow. And is it the same time zone as the UK? Did you have to deal with that?
It's only 2 hours difference, Doha to Ireland, so the jet lag wasn't too strong, thankfully, and it was also quite useful because I was covering the event for a couple of Irish newspapers, so to have that extra 2 hours in the evening before the print deadlines was a bit of a luxury. Sometimes you're running around like a headless chicken, but I suppose that happened a few times as well.
So what was your highlight? I guess the biggest highlight was the victory of the Press 800.
Self praise is no praise, but that was a good laugh. Yeah, I was, as I say, I wasn't the fastest, I was the least slowest member of the media who did the 800.
Any BBC guys in there? They didn't put Michael Johnson, well, he's just recovered from a kidney problem, hasn't he? But they didn't put any pundits in there from the BBC.
None of the I know Andrew Cotter usually did it. I'm not sure because there were so many people there, but I'd heard he was going to do it, one of the commentators, and he's a pretty good runner as well. But none of the Steve Krems or Paula Radcliffe showed up anyway, thankfully. But yeah, it's a good laugh every year, or every World Championships they do it. It's like they cap it at 16 heats. So you had, what, maybe 130 athletes or so.
Wow.
Not 130 non-athletes, I should say, participating members of the media, and it's whoever clocks the fastest time in the overall 16 races brings themselves a nice watch. So thankfully that was me this time. So good old laugh, and it's a great way for all the media who are most of the week spend buried in their laptops and phones to sort of have an event where they all get to hang out and meet everyone from all around the world.
Yeah, nice. And you've run 156.
Yeah. So. Not bad, not too fast either. There was a Japanese guy in my heat who apparently had run 149.
Wow.
And usually if you break 2 minutes, it's enough to win that media race. But he was apparently, someone said he was Japanese national record holder at some point, which I don't know. But he went out in 56 for the first lap. And as you can imagine, I wanted no part in that. So I stayed well off the pace. And thankfully, he faded a bit in the second lap. But yeah, all in good fun.
Yeah, excellent. So looking at the action on the, well, obviously yours was action on the track, but looking at the top action on the track, let's say, but like before the championships, I saw loads of stuff in the media about like trying to big up stars. Like there was Noah Lyle was being mentioned as the guy that has saved the sport now in the shadow of Bolt. Did anyone like emerge? Was there any new stars that came through that you noticed over the course of the week's action?
Certainly, yeah. There was lots of young guns really rising to the occasion, and I suppose a few old stagers as well, proven they were still on top, like the Shelly Ann Fraser Prices of this world. 1071 after having a baby a little over a year ago is astonishing, and even Nia Ali as well, just coming back to win the 100-meter hurdles, is an astonishing performance. But some of the new stars, I suppose, who emerged in the women's high jump, Yaroslava Maguchi of Ukraine. She broke the world junior record twice.
Oh, wow.
In that final to win the silver medal behind Maria Lazitskene.
Yeah.
And Lazitskene was all her own way in the high jump for a number of years now, winning her third world title. But she got a hell of a challenge from Maguchi, and Maguchi looks like an athlete. She's only 18 years old. And I was talking to her in Stockholm earlier this year. And you know, she was very much cramming for her exams in school alongside doing Diamond Leagues for the first time ever.
Wow.
And she went and won the European under 20 title, and she's only training, like she said, for jumping. She only trains about 3 days a week, and then she might do one or two more days in the gym. So you can imagine that is just absolute pure talent, and obviously been coached very well at this stage, but you know, certainly not progressed to elite level training. And yet there she was, the second best in the world, and primed, I suppose, to take over that event in the years ahead.
Wow.
Lots of us in the women's 400, Salwa Eid Nasser of Bahrain. I suppose a lot of Bahraini athletes are typically, you know, imports. They're, you know, paid to run for Bahrain, but in fairness to Salwa, she moved there, I suppose, before she was a high-level athlete. She moved there in her early teens. One of her parents is Bahraini, the other one is Nigerian.
Hmm.
And she moved there, I suppose, for non-sporting reasons initially, and has obviously matured into an unbelievable athlete, and took down the raging hot favourite, Sean Emile Wibo, and that, to win that women's 400 was one of the fastest times we've ever seen. So that was an astonishing... She was another, I suppose, star of the sport breaking out. And again, other stars then, Tajay Gale in the men's long jump, from one of the biggest shocks of all. And he jumped 8.69. He went 10th on the world all-time list. He's only 23 years old.
This is the Jamaican guy.
Astonishing performance.
Yeah.
And he won that by 30 centimeters. So to beat the best in the world by a foot, when no one even probably expected you to win a medal almost. That was really one of the stunning performances of the week. Some great comebacks as well, you know, in the 3,000 meter steeplechase, you had Conceslas Caputo, who was basically he was like the fourth or fifth favorite, despite being the reigning world and Olympic champion, to win that title. Earlier on in the year, in April, he got a navicular stress fracture and was told he has to take 2.5 months off. So he was about a month into his rest and back home. And as all injured athletes are, was doing his head in, losing fitness every week. So he decided to get his training partners to build a little makeshift backyard pool in his backyard in Missouri, off in Kenya. And it's a tiny little thing. It's like 5 meters long, maybe 2 meters wide. And they built it over the course of a few days. They used water that's normally used for watering the vegetable gardens in their kind of their estate or whatever you call it, and that the cows drink as well. So it wasn't exactly the cleanest water in the world. And he got in there every day. He said he'd do about, you know, he'd get in there about three times a day. He said he'd do an hour, hour and a half. So all told, he might do 5 hours of aqua running with a kind of an inflatable donut ring, rubber ring around his waist to keep him afloat. And that was his training for a couple of months. And then he got back running in June. Didn't run well in Diamond League races when he finally made it back racing in August, and people really were writing him off. But again, he had 3 weeks between the last Diamond League and between coming to Doha, and that was just about enough to do enough speed training. And he relied on, I mean, it was just a sign of a champion, really, because he came back from no one expecting him to win, and he probably had 2 meters to find. He said he messed up the final bend. He planned to be with the leader, the Ethiopian leader, over the last barrier with about 70 meters to run. He still had 2 meters to find because he wasn't too good at the previous hurdles. And yet he found something within, found that extra speed to come back and win it by 1/100 of a second. And what really was, I think it was the closest finish of the week. And it was also definitely the most thrilling race of the week for me.
Really? Because he looked, I saw him on the line and I was talking to my wife, and I said, he doesn't look in good shape. He didn't look that, you know, you look at the other guys and there's not an ounce on him. And he didn't look as if he was in tip-top condition. I thought there's no way he's going to win it. But his guts, like you say, in that last 20 meters to just throw everything at it was incredible, really.
Exactly, he's it's the mark of a true champion, you know. And he was even, I got to sit down and interview him then afterwards, and he was just saying, you know, a sign of a true champion as well. He was saying about other athletes, you know, on the Kenyan team, they listen. He was like, oh, they listen too much to other people. You know, they get affected about their tactics. He was like, I don't listen to anybody. And his agent was actually there, and he was just joking as well, Misha Booting, that, yeah, you don't listen to anyone. You won't even listen to me most of the time. But he does things his own way.
Yeah, excellent. And then there was a lot of controversy about the championships. Firstly, from the perspective of the crowds, and obviously you were there throughout the championships. It was terrible at the beginning. I think in the 100 meters, the women's race, you know, she was running around Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce, and there's nobody in the stadium. Did it get any better? And do you know how it got better?
It did get a lot better, and it actually wasn't. It's the ironic thing that when there was, even the night when Shelly-Ann Fraser-Pryce won that 100 meter gold medal, it was this Sunday night. There was actually a reasonable crowd in earlier that night. Now, it wasn't a good crowd. Let's be honest. It was 7,000 people, I think it was, which wasn't that much. When she won that 100 meters, there was probably about 1,500 people in the stadium. And then obviously they all left on the lap of honor. There was a couple of hundred people left. But the problem was, because of the European TV market, that's how the timetable was created to fit. So, i.e. BBC. So it'll be prime time, you know, 7 till 10 p.m. in Britain, in, say, France as well. And it was that bit later over in Doha, which wouldn't be a problem if it was at the weekend when people don't have work to get up for the next morning. The weekend in Doha is Friday and Saturday. People are working on Sunday. People are working on Monday over there. And because of that, if that race, that 100-meter race, took place at 11:20 p.m., Now, if you held a race at 11:20 p.m. in the majority of cities around the world where the whole workforce had already been at work that day, and especially because so much of the workforce is migrant workers, it's kind of laborers on building sites, a lot of people who would have been going to the championship, you know, they have to get up at, like, I was talking to a friend of mine, was talking to some of them who was over watching, and they were saying, you know, our alarm clocks go at 5 a.m. in the morning for work. So yeah, it's understandable that a lot of evenings people would come to the stadium and then they'd watch for a couple hours. And then regardless of whether the best races were at the end, they'd be like, right, well, I've worked to get up for tomorrow morning. It's already 11 p.m. I'm going home. And that was unfortunate, that embarrassing sight of the women's 100 meters playing out to a virtually empty stadium was because of that. Things did get better. Ticket sales were poor. The local organizing committee, there's no way around it, they did a poor job promoting the championships and selling tickets. People I know from Britain, from Ireland, who were trying to buy tickets, had a serious problems, you know, a month out of where do we even buy tickets. A lot of people in Doha knew the championships was on and wanted to go and didn't even know how to get tickets.
Really?
And met the brother of Craig Engels just before the men's 1500 meter final, outside the stadium, and he was wandering around probably 10 minutes before the 1500 meter semi final, going, where do I buy tickets? Like, you know, people didn't even know. And his brother, he'd flown all the way from Mississippi, like, or is he from Mississippi? I can't even remember exactly where he's from. But his brother, his sister, his mother were all there in their American gear. And 10 minutes before his race, they were trying to find where to buy tickets.
No.
But I think at that stage, they were actually letting people in for free. And I know some people I was talking to over there who teach over there, some expats, were just saying that, you know, they got free tickets through their school and stuff. And I think that was the case, that 100 meter night, as bad as it was, it embarrassed the organizers into taking action at long last, because there was a laughing stock of the sporting world that night.
Yeah.
And it was such a discredit to the athletes, really, to have an empty stadium. So as the week went on, they bussed in. They had members of the military bussed in to fill up the stands. A lot of the migrant workers, the expats, were given free tickets, and there was buses put on to even bring them. And towards, like, you know, it's 10-day championships, and after maybe 5 days, 6 days, it really picked up. You had the final weekend. You had, I think on day 8, you had 42,000 in the stadium one of the nights. And it was that was the night of Mutaz Essebarshin's world high jump title. And obviously every championships loves the best night is generally always when the home hero wins a gold medal, and Barshin pulled it out again, much like Caputo was injured for most of the year, had only jumped 227 this year. And again, being a champion, what champions do, pulled it out and jumped 237 to defeat the two Russian neutral athletes. And that was an amazing night's competition. That was also the night Caputo won the steeple. And the stands were absolutely packed, and full credit there goes to the Ethiopian workers, the Kenyan workers who live in Doha, because there was a few thousand of them, and, you know, even just a couple of thousand of them make as much noise as 10 or 12 or 15,000 Irish or Brits or Parisians or French, you know, fans, in terms of their volume they create, the atmosphere they create. It really is astonishing.
Yeah.
And I went over for the men's 5K final. I went over and sat down in that section that they were all in, and it was an unbelievable sporting atmosphere to be at.
Yeah,
and again, most of them wouldn't pay for the tickets, so you have that issue of, you know, they clearly weren't fans of the sport. They were obviously cheering on their countrymen and women, but it is a pity that, I suppose, when you go to a place like Doha, you can't fill up the stands with any other option other than putting on buses and allowing people to come in for free. But I think at that point, that was the only measure that was really
just had to go
that
for
they,
it.
The only option they had to try and fill up the stands, and it worked, really. So the last 5-6 days were actually quite good and enjoyable, and there was a great atmosphere.
Yeah.
But I suppose the media had their narrative set from that first weekend. They kind of wanted the championships to be a disaster. So
yeah,
those photos went around the world of the empty stands a lot more than the photos of the full stands did later in the week.
Yeah. And another sort of controversy, obviously, again, was at the start of the championships, and perhaps got better through the course. It was the weather, particularly for the women's marathon, which seemed completely crazy. Like, was it that bad? I mean, the men's marathon wasn't quite as bad, I think, later on in the week. But was it crazy having that sort of distance running races in that kind of heat and humidity?
It was crazy. It was absolutely bonkers. I mean, it's been done before. You know, I suppose people did, like I said, about the media narrative was wanting the championships to be a disaster, because that was the kind of idea beforehand.
Yeah.
But we have had championships like that before in Osaka. You know, we've had temperatures in the 30s and high humidity. Next year in Tokyo, the Olympic marathon, would be held in very similar conditions. It would be in the low 30 degrees and humidity would be through the roof. Obviously, it's not ideal. I was there for the women's marathon. It was the best way I could describe it, and this is only being a spectator who was running around the media area and walking back and forth around the finish line, was it was suffocating. It was, yeah. It felt like you almost had to breathe into the air. Obviously, you had the heat, but it's the old adage is true about it's not the heat, it's the humidity that kills you. It really felt like trying to breathe with like a pillow almost over your face. It felt like there was no oxygen in the air. Like I suppose being in a steam room, I suppose, where you just have that fog just coating the air, and it's like you feel short of breath just sitting there or standing there. And to run a marathon in those conditions, I felt such sympathy for the athletes, really, because it was just horrendous. And the sight of them, you know, they had all the wheelchairs and medics set up near the finish line. They had medics every, you know, in fairness to the other left, they had every measure in place to try and make things as good as possible in that regard, and the organizers. But when you hold a marathon and, you know, it's 33 degrees or so, 32, 33 at the start, and the humidity was 77%, it's always going to be a mess, really. And, you know, 28 out of the 68 athletes didn't finish. That's just over 40%.
Crazy.
And these are world-class women who are used to enduring the worst pain imaginable, and, you know, more than nearly half the field didn't finish. And you had, like, I watched an Italian runner just mid-stride, just her legs go, and she buckled onto the concrete ground, like, you know, and then she was put in a wheelchair and led away to the medical center, just bawling her eyes out, you know. And it was just being around that medical center towards by the finish, even during the race and after race, there'd be a new athlete coming every 5 minutes on a stretcher, on a wheelchair, supported by medics as they hobbled and then taken in for treatment. It was, in a weird way, it was an opportunity for some athletes, because it was such a leveler that the ones who had prepared well, like you had a 41-year-old mother or two who works as a full-time nurse, finished sixth in the women's race, Roberta Groner, and I suppose the class did tell, with Ruth Chepngetich, the favorite, did win that race, and one of the favorites, Lalisa De Sisa, won the men's race. But the men's race then a week later was completely different, you know. The temperature wasn't that different, I think it was still low 30s, but the difference, when we got off the bus that night, we came from the stadium there last Saturday night and just got off the bus, and we were like, it was like night and day. I think the humidity was only in the 40%, and it really just showed you, it felt fresh. And it was the first time in 9 days in Doha where you actually took a breath outdoors and it felt like there was fresh air to breathe.
Wow.
So it was surprised the men, you know, as a result, did have it much easier, and there was hardly any of the same kind of sights you saw of athletes and bodies just strewn everywhere after the finish for the men's race.
Speaking of preparation for that men's race, British interest was with Callum Hawkins, and there's been talk of him preparing by buying loads of heaters from Aldi and putting a treadmill in his shed and trying to recreate the conditions there, which is, he had an amazing run, really, to be again in with a chance for a global medal, but just falling short. Did you see that at the end of that race?
I did, yeah. I was at that, and spoke to Callum as well after it, and, you know, he gave it everything. I mean, it's cruel that he finishes fourth in two major championship marathons, and then the other one, the Commonwealth Marathon that he led in the Gold Coast, was obviously the one where the sun got to him and he collapsed on the road. And so, yeah, it was a cruel fate for him, but, you know, I suppose there couldn't be any regrets. He ran the perfect race, and as you said, the lengths he went to prepare, I think he said he had his shed up to 39 degrees Celsius at one point with those heaters around it, as he ran on that treadmill. But again, as not annoyed, but as disappointed as he was to just miss a medal, he pointed out rightly after a race that he was coming in behind three athletes in Caputo, Geramu and De Sisa, who are truly the cream of the crop. You know, that was a race that was worthy of a London Marathon podium, a New York Marathon, a Chicago, a Boston Marathon podium.
Yeah.
You had 202, 203 athletes in there. And as he said himself, I've got that close. He was like, if that was Berlin, if that was London, and I got that close to those athletes, I would be absolutely over the moon, and it's the closest I've ever got to them. So he said, you know, it's a year out from Tokyo, that's how close I've got to the very best in the world. You know, barring, say, your Kipchoge's, your Kenenisa Bekele's, these guys are the best in the world. And he got that close to him. So that bodes well for the fact that, given the Tokyo Olympic marathon next year for him will be an equally, I suppose, or perhaps worse war of attrition, he could well run himself onto a podium there if he comes on another bit, especially now having had that experience of running so well in those kind of conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. And from an overall distance running perspective, I guess There was quite a lot of interesting races. The 5K was a great race, with Edris winning, and the steeplechase was good, and the female races with Hassan running particularly well. Like, was there? Did we learn anything new? Like it was still dominated by East African runners, I guess, to a certain extent. But was there any sort of trends we noticed in Doha? Did anything change particularly in the general scene of distance running in the world?
Not really, I would say, because it was almost a lot of the breakthrough events we talked about. Obviously, the distance races tended to be kind of the opposite. It was the established champions who reigned supreme, you know. Yeah. You had Helen O'Beery in the women's 5K, who wasn't in her best form this year, but came through. She was world cross country champion, took the gold there, probably against the odds, really. Mm. Because a lot of people thought maybe she was vulnerable this year. Hassan was obviously roaring hot favourite for the 15 and 10K. She did the business in both of them in the most impressive style imaginable. On the men's side, then you had Kipruto obviously winning the steeple. Women's steeple, you had Chepkoech, the world record holder, running away from everyone. Men's 1500, you had Chariot doing the business, much like Hassan, all on his own in one of the most impressive championship 1500 finals I've ever seen an athlete run, an individual race to run as fast as he did. And then men's 5K was obviously Edris again against the odds. No form all season. He'd been battling injuries even between the heat and the semi. He said he had a lower back issue and had to have treatment. Yeah. He had a T-Care machine treatment on that, and he said he was in quite a bit of pain after his heat. But came through and rose to the occasion in the final. And then the men's 10K, you had world cross country champion Joshua Cheptegei, second to Mo Farah 2 years ago, doing the business there over 10K and holding off the late surge from Jomitka Jelcha. So really, I suppose it was the established order, the established senior stars of their events reigned supreme in the distance races. But I think for the first time, perhaps ever, really, we saw in a lot of those middle and long distance races the ability of athletes to front run and still succeed. We saw Sifan Hassan, we saw Timothy Chariot do it in both the 1500 races. They took over, like Chariot led every step. Hassan led for probably three quarters or more. She took over after the first 250 or so of that 1500. They did it all on their own. Chepkoech and the steeple did it all on their own. And normally that's a bit of a recipe for disaster in a middle distance race, because you're setting yourself up, unless you have a major edge on form, you're going to be setting it up for other athletes to sit on you and then out kick you.
Yeah.
But they clearly all had enough of strength and enough speed and enough supremacy really over their rivals that they were able to do that, which I suppose is a measure of their ability.
Yeah.
But obviously we saw that backfire as well in an 800 meter race, because Aggie Wilson, who was, I think she was the bookies, she was one of the shortest price favorites of the week. She was like 1-8 with the British bookmakers to win that. There were very few favorites that people had as much certainty about as Aggie Wilson in that 800, but she tried to lead all the way. And it just didn't come off for her, really. She faded back to third. And so that really was not a result. She was very upset afterwards, you know, and not pleased about that. But that shows you really that it can backfire at times. And I suppose Aggie, she is clearly the best 800 meter runner in the world in like a Diamond League race. She's proven that during the summer, but in a championship setting, obviously, is very different.
Different, yeah. And again, back to controversy, all of this was a bit overshadowed by the fact that, Salazar's ban. I don't know how to phrase it, but who came out with that? The verdict. It wasn't an IAAF.
No. It was the US Anti-Doping Agency, and it was an investigation that had been going on for a number of years, and it dropped on Monday night. It was released in Doha time. It was obviously during the evening kind of time in US time. And it was both the best and worst timing for such news to drop. And I suppose you'd wonder whether that was coincidental on the behalf of the US Anti-Doping Agency. But obviously the final arbitration panel had made the decision that day. So they thought rather than delay it until after the World Championships, they'll just release it straight away. And because it was obviously between Sifan Hassan's first gold medal in the 10K and her second gold medal in the 1500. You had athletes like Donovan Brazier and Clayton Murphy in the men's 800. They had already run their semi-final and made their way into the 800 final, which was the following evening.
Yeah.
So you can imagine it truly was a storm of just suspicion, innuendo, questions and answers and arguments and everything. It was It kind of is a habit of athletics, really, that there tends to be some sort of scandal around every championships.
Yeah.
And this was the biggest scandal as you can get, one of the most successful coaches in the sport, if not the most successful, certainly the most successful middle and long distance coach of the last decade, two decades even, exposed as for what he was, what he is, a cheat. And yeah, there was not really two ways about it. There was three different counts that the US Anti-Doping Agency found where he'd violated anti-doping rules. And it, of course, cast a shadow over the whole Nike Oregon project, because as much as people disassociated with him, and it's true, you know, a lot of the athletes like Brazier, you know, they are coached by Pete Julian, who was Salazar's assistant, and you know, he was the one who writes the program. But at the same time, you cannot disassociate Nike Oregon project from Alberto Salazar. He was the founder, he was the innovator, he was the one who I suppose drove the bus all those years, and is the figurehead of the entire thing. And the ethos of the Oregon project was born and molded into what it was through his work.
Yeah.
And now we've seen that his work, and I think the best line I've seen anywhere was by Bernie Rone in The Guardian, in a column he wrote the other day, analyzing Salazar and the response to Salazar's ban. And he said that we have a murder, but we have no body. Yeah. And that's it. We have a coach who is banned, and yet we have no athletes who are banned. And we have a horde of athletes obviously trying to disassociate themselves from him, which really, in a sense, is rewriting history, given so many of them knew about these allegations as far back as 2015, when the documentary on BBC and ProPublica was first published in June 2015. The investigation, through the brilliant work of David Epstein and Mark Daly, all of these allegations were known since then through whistleblowers like Kara Goucher, through Steve Magnus. And for anyone to, I suppose, claim naivety in joining the Oregon Project after that, or naivety by sticking with the Oregon Project, sticking with Salazar through that time, it kind of beggars belief. But at the same time, you tend to feel a bit of sympathy for a lot of those athletes, because really, you know, it's a case of don't bite the hand that feeds you. And unfortunately, in athletics, Nike is the company that feeds so many agents, so many coaches, so many athletes. It's their livelihood. And if you speak out against Salazar, either then and perhaps now, given Nike has put their backing behind Salazar, you are going to find yourself a lot more difficult to make a living in this industry of athletics. And it's not the way it should be, but it's the way it is. Okay. So while I certainly wouldn't have any sympathy for athletes who are being tarnished by association with Salazar, given what was known about him, I have a certain level of sympathy for them in terms of not being able to perhaps express their true emotions about Salazar or about the ban if they are clean athletes, given that Nike has such a powerful influence in the sport, and Salazar and Nike, in essence, for so long have been one and the same.
Yeah. And what's the future then for the Oregon Project? Nike have backed him in this dispute.
They have, and it's nauseating almost to see the reaction from Nike. Mark Parker, their CEO, sending a memo around to employers and putting in capital letters that at Nike we do the right thing. And really, that was just laughable. You know, anyone who knows the smallest thing about Nike and their history with sweatshops in Indonesia, or their workers' rights abuses all around the world at their factories, know that they're a company that very much does not do the right thing.
No. Alison Felix Armstrong, this year with the pregnancy, they didn't, you know, they never do the right thing, do they?
Yeah, occasionally they do, but usually they do the right thing when it suits their bottom line.
Yeah.
And we saw that with Lance Armstrong, you know, like even in August, I think it was of 2012, they continued to back Lance Armstrong when everything was known about him. Even when he got suspended, when USADA stripped him of his titles, it was a few months after that that they finally climbed off the Lance Armstrong ship, having really just ridden it into the sunset for so many years, for the better part of 15 years before that, when it suited their bottom line to make Lance the poster boy, even when they knew all the allegations. Yeah. All they would have had to do was pick up the phone and talk to some of his teammates who were making allegations, his former masseur, talk to the journalists who were investigating them. Nike never bothered to do that because deep down, I guess, they knew the truth and they knew that Lance suited business. Similarly with Salazar, he's so embedded. There was a building on the Nike campus in Beaverton, Oregon, named after Salazar. He was based on their campus. There was a level of secrecy surrounding what the Oregon Project did all along. Even athletes who were part of the group will say there was a certain level of secrecy when it came to Salazar and one or two other members, there was an inner circle, Kara Goucher said, that people couldn't penetrate, besides maybe certainly Galen Rupp was on the inner circle with Salazar. And Goucher said, you know, when Mo Farah arrived, that he was also on the inner circle, and there was outer rings to the Oregon project. And in that sense, I very much feel for a lot of those athletes who were maybe came out of college, they got an agent, they signed a professional contract that was put in front of them, they went to the Oregon project. There's a strong chance a lot of those athletes were not doing anything illegal and have never done anything illegal, but they weren't the ones chosen by Salazar as the ones that he was going to, I guess, cheat with.
Yeah.
And now that they have, through, I suppose, for economic and financial reasons, were almost forced to sign a deal that brought them to the Oregon Project. And because maybe they might not have seen anything untoward in their time there, they might even be slightly defensive of Salazar and of the Oregon Project as a whole, given that they, you know, in a lot of ways, they do push the boundaries in a good way. They have innovative with coaching. They have the best sports science backup, and they have a truly professional approach to the sport. But the figurehead and the mastermind behind it all has now been exposed as a cheat. So, yeah, I suppose for athletes who are now tarnished by this, in one way, I have sympathy for them. And in another way, you could say they only have themselves to blame, because if they'd wanted to know all this, they could have known all this a long time ago.
Yeah. And looking at the championship and this, well, the period, let's say, so with the Oregon Project verdict, but also with the championship as a whole, what does it mean for athletics at the moment? What sort of place are we in? And what's the IAAF, their reputation is, I'd say, pretty tarnished at the moment. I think Co had a weird kind of spat with Gabby Logan, which I don't know what his reasoning behind that was, really. But what's the shape of athletics like at the moment, do you think, sort of internationally?
I think it's not as bad as a lot of people are saying, because I think when you host a world championships in a place like Doha, you know, a lot of media come out of the woodwork who have no interest in the sport for 51 weeks of the year, and they'll show up out of the championships. Like, when it goes to a place like Doha that really has so many issues, you know, there was corruption involved in this bid. This bid went to Doha back in 2014 under the previous regime, the IAAF, Lamine Diack, who basically ran it like a dictatorship. Whatever he said went in the IAAF in its previous guise before Seb Cole came in 2015. So I do feel a bit of sympathy at times for like the current people in the IAAF who are dealing with all the dirty dealings that Lamine Diack did during his long term as IAAF president. This was one of them. And we know that there is so much shadiness around the successful bid of Doha to host this, as there is around the 2022 World Cup with FIFA.
Yeah.
That Doha or Qatar was successful in bidding for. And really, so the media went there, and we know that Doha is, like, you know, a city that has so many issues in the Qatari government with human rights. You know, there are hundreds of workers dying every year from Southeast Asia, from Nepal, Pakistan, these places, like, who are coming here on promise, coming not here, but coming to Doha on the promise of, you know, better wealth. And then what they're being sold essentially is a lie. They've had passports confiscated. They've been forced to work hours way beyond in very dangerous, like, conditions during the summer. And hundreds of them every year are dying of heat stroke and heart problems. And the Qatari government is trying to sweep it under the rug. And all that is, for me, the biggest reason of all, beyond the marathoners or anyone else, or beyond the time difference, or beyond the humility that we shouldn't, or beyond even the corruption in the bids. That, for me, is the reason that we shouldn't be going to a place like Qatar for a major championships, even though a lot of sports are inevitably seeing that it's going to bolster their bank balance by doing business with Qatar. So I think that's the reason we shouldn't be going. But however, the fact that we did go, I think that's the reason there was so much negative coverage of it, was these issues are there. So the media went there with a preconceived idea, what they wanted to report. They wanted the championships to be a disaster. So every negative thing that happened, they jumped on. When there was positive things, I think largely they were ignored. You know, like, you had a lot of local athletes would have come out on, or a lot of locals, and I mean native Qataris as well, not expats, not migrant workers who came there from other countries, actually came out on the last Friday night to watch Mutez Essebershin, who's a national hero in Qatar, and who is a homegrown Qatari athlete as well. He came up through the Qatari Aspire system there in Doha,
yeah.
Unlike a lot of other successful athletes in Qatar who essentially have been bought in to run for Qatar. Barshim is a legend in Qatar, and a lot of the locals did come out in the final weekend to watch him and show their interest and support for him. But, you know, I suppose that was a good news story for them, for the Qataris, but a lot of media kind of ignore that one, really, because the full stands and the actual Qataris taking an interest in athletics didn't really fit what they wanted to portray of Qatar. But at the same time, I mean, if you compare the crowds to previous championships, it was very poor. You know, Beijing 2015 was packed. Moscow had just under 400,000 across the week, an average of, you know, maybe 40,000 each day during their championships. Qatar, London, of course, in 2017 was packed to the absolute rafters every night and for many of the morning sessions even. So we didn't have that this time. Obviously, the crowds were way down, which you'd expect them to be. But I read a lot of articles and saw a lot of coverage online that people said this is the death knell for athletics going to Qatar. And you're kind of reading this going, but it's not, because this is just one subpar championships.
Yeah.
There are many events around the Diamond League that are still selling out to packed houses, like in Zurich, like in Oslo. Great crowds. I was in Paris this year, brilliant crowds there as well. And then you look back on recent championships, you look back on Berlin last year that had, I think it had, was it 700,000 spectators, paying customers coming through the doors during the a European championship as well, not even a world championships. You know, just astonishing level of interest in the sport. And, you know, I think what it showed as well is the athletes will deliver. You know, it was the best performance-wise, it was the best world championships ever by athletes. A lot of that is down to, you know, improved technology, faster tracks, the spikes. Particularly the ones that Nike are now making are really pushing the boundaries, I suppose, almost of legality again in terms of the technology they're putting in their footwear.
Yeah.
And that is all creating, you know, better performances. So the athletes certainly stepped up. And I think what we saw is, as much as there is so much scandal and bad things in the sport, we saw the Salazar ban. You know, we saw the women's marathon being staged in awful conditions, and we saw at times empty stands. There's also so much good to the sport. And I think at times when the mainstream media dip into the sport for that 1 week of the year, they only really want to report the negative when there is so much positive to the sport. And really, that's kind of annoying, because when you see their coverage of more mainstream sports, like, you know, the Rugby World Cup is going on here at the moment, and the main talk you'll see in the media and on TV, and it's about the game, you know, they'll talk about the players. Yes, there's bad stuff. The weather is really humid. It's not ideal. There's a lot of players dropping balls and stuff. Like, they're, yeah, like there's a doping question going on there as well. You know, you have 300-pound rugby players who have 5% body fat, which any condition coach can tell you is nigh on impossible without drugs. But it's all just overlooked. You know, the negative stuff is kind of like, oh, whatever, it's not a big deal. Let's talk about the sport. But for some reason, in athletics, it's always, let's talk about the scandal. And then sport is an afterthought if it's even mentioned at all.
Yeah.
And that can be annoying when you're in the sport and you're covering the sport all year, because, yes, the corruption, the doping, the farce of going to Qatar in the first place is an important element that needs to be part of the coverage. But it's not the only element. And the biggest disservice the media does, and even the mainstream people who only talk about that and who write off the entire sport when they read those stories, is you're doing the biggest disservice to the athletes, the clean athletes who are there winning medals, trying their heart out, only to show up at a championship and hear that the only thing people are talking about, either in the media or back home, the fans on TV, is the scandal. And so really, they're the ones who lose out most of all, which really, in a sporting sense, is a travesty.
Yeah. And on that note, let's not talk about any more scandal. Let's talk about this weekend, another sort of breaking barriers and fantastic performances. Eliud Kipchoge, you're off to Austria, off to Vienna to watch him attempt to break the 150 or the 2 hour barrier. How are you feeling for
it? Yeah. So it's going to be very interesting. I'm heading over there Thursday and be writing about it for Runner's World website, and it should be really interesting. We obviously have seen basically a carbon copy of this event before in 2017 through Nike's Breaking 2 attempt, where they, I suppose, released as well in conjunction with that their Vaporfly shoe, which has really revolutionized marathon times, both among the mass market and among the elite level.
Yeah.
It is a shoe that definitely works. They claimed 4% boost in running economy. The one, their next percent shoe was 4.5%, I think, boost in running economy.
Yeah.
And I believe Kipchoge is wearing something new again, and he's been trialing something new again in training, which is the latest innovation, I suppose, that they have. And it's almost comical to look at the shoe, how big it is. The size of the sole is huge. There's certainly a big blade in there and a lot of cushioning that might just give him. And I think he's going to do it. They have 41 pacemakers recruited world-class athletes in themselves. With people like, you know, Bernard Lagat would be part of it. A couple other athletes I was talking to about it in Doha, like Lopez Lamont, Matt Centrowitz. They'll be running, you know, 5K or so. I think Matt Centrowitz was saying he'll be doing 2 legs of 5 kilometers. And he was saying, like, thank God it's not more than that, because, like, I don't think I could do more than that. Keep up with Kipchoge. He's a world-class 5K man himself. So Kipchoge is doing this. It is, for a guy who's won everything, I think if he had not set the world record in Berlin, was it now, just over a year ago, I don't think we'd be seeing him commit to this. The fact he got his hands, he obviously committed to the first attempt with Nike in 2017, and his coach, Patrick Sang, was quite worried that would have such, he put so much into it, now obviously just missed it by 25 seconds, put so much into that his coach was worried about his future in terms of, he's like, that might have been the end of him, that might have been his best performance, and he didn't get it. Thankfully, it wasn't. He came back, what was it, maybe 16 months later, set the official world record of 201.39 in Berlin. And I think the fact that he got that official world record, and obviously Bekele has since just missed it by a few seconds, but I think the fact that he is now the official world record holder in the meantime has meant to Kipchoge, he wants 2 things for the rest of his career. He wants to win another Olympic gold in Tokyo, but obviously before then, and I think the reason he's doing this is he wants that 2-hour barrier to fall.
Yeah,
there's no doubt that even with Kipchoge and Kenenisa Bekele's brilliance, we're not going to see a sub-2-hour marathon for decades under legal conditions, and where an athlete has to do it on their own, where they're not getting, where they won't have a car driven in front of them moving at 2-hour pace, where they won't get drinks more often than they're allowed, where they won't have a team of pacers rotating in front. So that's the reason this is the only way a 2-hour marathon will be possible. The legal amount of drop is being allowed under records, so it is technically a downhill race, but it's within the IAAF specifications for being considered a flat course. It'll be on a loop in a park in the middle of Vienna. And it'll be basically an up and back course that goes around a big roundabout. And such is the level of investment and detail going into this. I heard the figure 15 million being bandied about that Ineos, the sponsors, have put into this. Such is the level of cost, and obviously you've Britain's richest man, Jim Ratcliffe, who is the one behind Ineos, and who are dipping their toe into sports through obviously the team Ineos in cycling and through this now in athletics in recent years. Such is the level of cost that they have, or I suppose money that they have, that I was talking to someone out in Doha who said that actually when they go around the roundabouts, they're essentially building a camber, much like an indoor track in athletics. So that even though it's a really wide roundabout, that they don't really need to camber at all, just to give him that extra, really? I don't know, whether it's half a second as he goes around, they're building a camber so he can kind of run around leaning to the left almost as they run around that roundabout. That's obviously the level of detail they've gone to with this. He has better Nike shoes than he had 2 years ago. They've tweaked the pacemaking system to maybe make it slightly better. There's new technology coming on all the time, like Mauerten is the Swedish drink manufacturer who found a breakthrough way of, I suppose, getting energy into the system during marathons. A lot of kind of, you know, the 3-, 4-, 5-hour marathoners are all using that now. They've also been refining their technology in recent years. So really he has the best of the best of every single thing. And he has the best coach probably in the world, Patrick Sang, who's been working with him for 20 years now, who knows Kipchoge perfectly. And you have the ultimate marathoner, the best marathoner by far that we've ever seen, perhaps the best athlete we have ever seen, full stop, in athletics, in Eliud Kipchoge. And I think he's going to do it, really. If I was a betting man, and if you gave me 50-50 on it, I know which side I'd pick. I think he's going to go under the 2 hours.
Great. You heard it here first then. Fantastic.
I'll pretend to be a genius if it pays off, and if not, let's just never speak of this again, Sean.
Well, I better let you get yourself together. I can hear my baby shouting in the corner, so I better go and get back to my duties. But it's been great to chat, Cahill. Thanks for filling us in on Doha and this weekend's race, and enjoy the action this weekend.
Thank you very much, Sean, and have me back anytime.
Yeah, you got your mouth open.
That's the way we mark the end of the interview with a few face slaps. There, anyway. Yeah, so that was a nice interview with Carl Hall. Check out his report, I guess, on Runner's World for the Ineos sub 2 hour challenge this weekend. It's been declared for Saturday morning. Jermaine, you tuning in?
Saturday morning, I'll be doing bubble football and battle archery.
Okay.
Stag in Brighton.
Ah, okay, perfect. So they're not going to be watching. Whose stag is it? Can you reveal?
It's just a friend.
Okay.
A non-runner.
Non-runner. Okay. Enjoy.
Civilian.
Civilian. Yeah. In his civvy clothes, doing his civvy stag. Yeah, okay. How are you going to keep off the drink? Because you don't drink, right?
I don't drink, but that's fine. I don't need to drink.
No, okay. You're drunk. Because when I'm a drunk persona anyway.
When I do drink, it does the opposite. It makes me really slow yeah. and lethargic. So it's like, that's no good to me.
But it sounds fun. Enjoy it. But you'll be missing out a 2 hour attempt. You have to catch up with it in afterwards. Or you just read Carl's yes. report, man, and a week later it'll be out there.
I'll just WhatsApp you.
Yeah.
Or I'll get a link from that person on our data, tells me all the news updates.
Yeah. You can subscribe to our podcast email, which you get a weekly email from Hannah Viner, one of the she's a good writer. She'll write out, you know, she'll give you some updates on what's happened at the old Ineos. So yeah, do that. That's a link. If you go on Let's Get Running /podcast, check out the latest show. You can sign up and subscribe to that. We've had a review as well, Jermaine.
Go on. Bless me.
Well, it's funny. I'm only getting these through late, so I don't know what's going on here. But Gary Laybourne, good old Gary. I think Gary recently won a half marathon this weekend. Let me just check that out. I think he did. I think Gary.
Power 10, that. Google Spire Power 10.
Hang on. Because he tagged me into it, I think. And I gave him a bit of a like, but I didn't realise. Yeah, Gary Laybourne. He won the Richmond half marathon, I think. Yeah, he did. So congratulations, Gary. Kingston half marathon, I lie. He not only did he win that in 69 minutes, he also sent us a review in June. So this is just coming through. So I don't know what's going on with my Apple podcasts, but it said he's best running podcast out there, !! 5 stars. He says he's been listening for a long time now after top interviews of club mates Kevin Quinn and Tom Holden. Always informative and interesting, yet always light and funny too. Keep up the work, boys. Good work, boys. So Gary, congratulations, mate, on your half marathon, but also thanks for the review. So all of you runners out there winning half marathons and half marathons, 10Ks and all that sort of stuff, don't rest on your laurels. Give us a review as well. It's
so
nice.
The review system, your podcast account, is like you're running.
Yeah.
Get slower.
Always behind, yeah.
Yeah.
Always behind, yeah. Jesus, yeah. I wish I could catch up. Anyway, that was nice. Thanks,
Gary.
Violin
melody music, yeah? Violin melody music.
Violin, yeah. It's coming in strong. Yeah, anyway. But it's good. Thanks for that, Gary. And anyone else who wants to send us a review anywhere they get their podcasts, that's brilliant. Thanks very much. Yeah. So, yeah, that's it. That's it for the show. You're going to the stag, Jermaine. I'm going to be hopefully looking after Greta, who is back to full fitness, so I won't be knackered. I'll be back doing a bit of running, which should be good. Preparing for your arrival in December, Jermaine, when we're going to have to try and put you through your paces at cross country.
Please.
Yeah.
I'm going to Google some shortcuts.
Yeah. Boss Cross. That's all we've got to Google. Boss Cross. Anyway. Right, I'll let you go. You've got your dinner to cook and I'll get on with having a sleep. But yeah, speak next week.
Cool. See ya. Bye.
See ya. Bye.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.